This is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated March 8th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's story, top of the fold, front page, In IBM's Shadow, Toshiba Plots Future Here, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. This article is from the Research Triangle Park. Toshiba Global Commerce Solutions is still sharing the email network and even the building at IBM's Cornwallis Road campus, where most of its employees worked when the business was owned by IBM. But executives for TGCS, a retail hardware and software company created last year from IBM's $850 million sale of its retail store solutions unit to Tokyo-based Toshiba Tech, know that arrangement won't last forever. Real estate sources say the company is considering options for building a 200,000-square-foot office building or leasing that amount of space in an existing building within the next couple of years. It typically takes 18 to 24 months to build an office structure of that size. If either happens, it would signal the company's commitment to keep more than 450 high-paying jobs in the Triangle and to continue growing its job base in the region. A 200,000-square-foot office building has plenty of room for 600 employees or more. TGCS employs about 1,000 people globally. Toshiba Global Commerce Solutions spokeswoman Renee Kiefer says the company's intent is to continue growing in the local area for our headquarters. But she says there is no timetable to move the company outside of IBM's campus in the Research Triangle Park. We might need to move one day for expansion, she says. It's only prudent that we have early discussions. When IBM sold its personal computer unit to Lenovo in 2004, the two companies had a similar arrangement. Lenovo hired about 1,800 people who worked in IBM's PC division in RTP, and those employees continued working on IBM's campus and other nearby buildings until Lenovo's headquarters and campus in Morrisville opened in 2006. TGCS, under the direction of President and CEO Stephen Ladwig, is under a slightly different scenario because IBM retained a 19.9% ownership stake in the company. And the two companies still share many customers. TGCS is developing hardware and software that runs a retail store's cash registers at checkout and keeps track of inventory, and IBM continues to provide maintenance and warranty services to TGCS clients under multi-year service agreements. According to retail research firm RBR London, TGCS is the world's largest retail point-of-sale provider with more installed units at retail locations around the world than its largest three competitors combined. But even the biggest companies selling to the largest retailers are facing major competition from tablet and app developers who are reinventing the way retailers do business, says Dan Hopping, president and CEO of the retail consulting firm Next Retail Group in Raleigh. Retail technology is at a cusp, Hopping says. Everything is changing in retail. Hopping says he was recently in a New York store where all the cash registers were iPads, and the sales staff was using credit card readers made for the iPad to check out customers. Things have really gotten easy, he says. TGCS in January introduced its first new products, the TCX Gravity and TCX Wave, at the National Retail Federation's annual convention, that are both designed to help retailers keep up with the latest in technology. Hoping TGCS will have to stay ahead of all the change happening in retail. Their success will depend on the price of all that hardware and software, he says. This week's cover story, what rivalry? In local university labs, cooperation reigns, by Jason DeBrun. To sports fans, March is known for madness on college basketball courts and head-to-head showdowns among rivals and non-rivals alike. In research labs, though, competition falls by the wayside and collaboration is the name of the game. Well, Almost. We call it cooperation, says Terry Lomax, Vice Chancellor for Research, Innovation, and Economic Development at NC State University. That word being the combination of cooperation and competition. We all talk trash about basketball, she says, but emphasizes that it's in good fun and stops there. When it comes to research and discovery, it's a different story. Collaboration is incredibly important, especially here in the Triangle where we have complementary strengths, she says. There are so many ways that we can work together and be stronger. Shame on us if we don't. The sheer number of shared projects bears that out. Since 2008, researchers at UNC Chapel Hill, Duke University, and NC State have worked in various combinations on a whopping 3,090 projects. Duke and UNCCH have combined on the most with 2,061 partnerships between just those two universities. I don't think people realize how much collaboration goes on between the three universities. Says James Seidel, Duke University Vice Provost for Research. Forming partnerships makes sense because of the complementary strengths of each university. For example, NCSU boasts its College of Veterinary Medicine, while UNCCH and Duke have highly ranked medical schools. Duke and NC State also have strong engineering programs. So, as research in health and medicine grows more intricate, medical researchers increasingly, for example, rely on engineers to help develop medical devices or even delivery methods. Drug testing is often performed on animals before humans, so collaborations in that area are just as valuable. Also, agencies such as the National Institutes of Health that issue research grants are increasingly looking for collaboration, says Lomax, putting the Triangle in a good position to qualify for more grants, which only increases economic activity here. Lomax says the NIH and other agencies are learning that to solve big problems, you need big teams. That means the Triangle is well positioned for future grants. Already, UNC system schools bring in more than $1 billion annually in research grants, with UNCCH leading the way every year and NCSU second. Research collaboration is an area in which seemingly everyone agrees. It's encouraged from the top down through Lomax's office and even by the chancellors and presidents, but also at the researcher level, as many scientists have degrees from two or more universities and have friends or colleagues who work elsewhere. Technologies such as Skype have helped to bring researchers closer together as well as communication becomes easier. With computer programs that can handle large amounts of data, sending even the largest of research files is now manageable. Also, researchers in specific fields are increasingly forming meetup groups for scientists in their respective fields. Those include scientists not only from the universities, but also from industry, such as in crop science, biomedical or engineering fields, just to name a few. These collaborations make the whole much greater than the sum of its parts, Seidel says. In a complimentary article, Bringing in Dollars is at Bottom Line of Research Programs, by Jason DeBruin, from Chapel Hill. While researchers work together on projects, it's not all kumbaya and hugs. Before they can collaborate, after all, they must first devise their project and then sell it to win the dollars to carry it out. At the university level, there is competition to win projects themselves. Take, for example, a victory that Chapel Hill won when it lured Dr. Jeff Stringer away from the University of Alabama, Birmingham. Along with him, Stringer brought a project that has attracted $22 million in funding and could end up bringing in as much as $31 million. Stringer, an obstetrician, gynecologist, and his team's work involves ways to improve health in Zambia with a particular desire to improve women's health. The team began looking for a new academic home for their program in 2011, and Chapel Hill was attractive because of UNC Chapel Hill's Dr. Myron Cohen and his work on drastically reducing HIV transmission. Also attractive was a long-standing UNCCH project in Malawi, a neighbor to Zambia. The recruitment effort brought 13 new faculty members to the UNC Institute for Global Health and Infectious Diseases and resulted in the creation of the UNC Global Women's Health Division. Faculty members took up a residence in Africa and collaborate in research, teaching, and clinical care of women in Malawi and Zambia. Our aim is to establish the world's premier program in global women's health, and there's no better place on the planet to do that than UNC, says Stringer. There is already a huge capacity for this work within the UNC community and an obvious commitment to global health that spans the entire campus. We could not be more enthusiastic about joining UNC. Immediately, the program received praise from across the campus and support from the very top. The collaboration across departments and across countries, along with the focus on training future providers, is a key part of our mission, says Dr. William Roper, Dean of the UNC School of Medicine, when it was announced that Stringer would come to UNCCH. Becoming more competitive for research dollars is an imperative going forward, especially as budget cuts from Washington, D.C. reduce the pool from which to draw. The UNC system saw a steady increase in research funding and nearly doubled its award dollars from 1996 and 97 to 2003 and 4. The first year, it recorded more than $1 billion in research awards in 1 year. Since that year, however, the growth line has been lower, with the universities taking in $1.2 billion in awards in 2010-11, if not accounting for special awards attributable to the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, commonly referred to as the stimulus package. Leaders from the nation's top research universities have estimated that federal research spending will be trimmed by more than $12 billion in 2013, and by nearly $95 billion over the next 9 years, according to the Chronicle of Higher Education, which closely tracks academia. Now inside the front page, Local Leaders Cautious on Immigration, by Chris Bagley, from Raleigh. Owners and representatives of Triangle Area businesses say they're cheered by the prospect of immigration reform, but caution that an attempt at broad overhaul shouldn't preclude narrower laws that aimed at individual issues. Employers and their foreign-born employees face a vast array of restrictions and make use of an alphabet soup of visa programs. Different employers use different mixes of programs, and most could make use of piecemeal reform even without something as broad as the comprehensive reform championed by President Obama, immigration attorneys say. That's a particularly important point in the Triangle and other areas with large numbers of high-tech, high-paying jobs, they say. While illegal immigration and family-based visas are high-profile issues involving large numbers of immigrants, they're not necessarily the most important issues for software companies and architectural firms, for example. The entire media debate is focused on illegal aliens, and that can be vitriolic debate, unfortunately, says Murali Basham of the boutique immigration law firm Basham Spiro LLP in Raleigh. The debate has cooled since the November elections, but it could heat up again by the end of 2013 when politicians begin campaigning for primary elections, a top U.S. Chamber of Commerce official said February 28th at a seminar convened by the UNC Systems Center for International Understanding. Brought on in part by Republicans' new push to attract minority and immigrant voters, the calm is a unique opportunity. But business advocates also list numerous steps that would be relatively free of controversy. Immigration attorney Elliot Norman says the processes for obtaining work visas and green cards could be streamlined in various ways. Some are as narrow as defining terms like specialized knowledge, Norman says. An employer must certify that it hasn't been able to find a U.S. national with certain specialized knowledge when it applies for an H-1B visa for a foreign national. There are a lot of technical reforms that could be done, says Norman, a partner with William Mullins, APC, in Richmond, who has clients in North Carolina, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. Executives rattled off other priorities at the February 28th seminar. More H-1B visas, simplified use of the National E-Verify database, limits on state laws related to immigration, for example. Employers are especially keen to eliminate country-by-country limits on the numbers of immigrants who can receive permanent U.S. residency, which date to the 1950s. the number of India and China-born workers seeking green cards far exceed the quotas for those countries, attorney says. Jennifer Parser, a lawyer with Poynter Spruill in Raleigh, has suggested to Governor McCrory's administration that it make North Carolina or a region within the state into a regional center for foreign investment. A foreign national who invests $1 million in such a region is eligible for an EB-5, immigrant investor visa. Parser notes, the minimum threshold is $500,000 in areas with high unemployment, including numerous rural counties in eastern North Carolina, she says. And now, North Carolina retreats and will not allow a scores release. By Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. A long-running dispute that gave a large portion of the state's credit union industry a case of heartburn has been resolved. Rose Connor, acting head of the North Carolina Credit Union Division, the industry's state regulator, won't continue a policy of making public, normally super-secret financial strength regulatory ratings known as CAMEL scores for any state-chartered credit union. The decision is being embraced by federal regulators at the Alexandria, Virginia-based National Credit Union Administration, or NCUA, who were angered in late 2011 when Connor's predecessor, Jerry Day, permitted Raleigh-based State Employees Credit Union, CQ, to release its CAMEL score as a gesture of transparency. NCUA's response was to stop accepting audit reports done by the State Division and to order federal examiners into the field to undertake their own inspections. Last year, that left most of the North Carolina 87 state-chartered credit unions having to eat the time and cost of two separate financial exams, something they'll now avoid, given Connor's actions. NCUA Chairman Debbie Matz personally took the time to signal that the impasse has ended. With this new commitment and policy from the state regulator, we look forward to resuming joint examinations, training, and open communications with NCCUD, she said in a statement. North Carolina Credit Union League President and CEO John Redeberg says the settlement brings the industry a sense of relief. We are happy that both regulators sat down together, found common ground, and ultimately resolved this issue, he says. Connor joined the NCCUD 8 years ago and had more than 20 years of related regulatory experience in West Virginia prior to that. She succeeded Jay at the end of 2012. Jay had been scheduled to retire. It will be up to the new McCrory administration Commerce Secretary, Sharon Decker, to decide whether Connor now gets the job full-time. Whatever happens, the acting head has left her mark. I just felt we needed to move forward, says Connor. CAMEL is a widely used financial rating system that looks at an institution's capital adequacy, management, and other factors, assigning a score of 1 through 5. A score of 1 means excellent, with a 5 indicating serious, if not terminal, weaknesses. The long-standing policy of keeping the scores secret began to rankle SECU President James Blaine in the fall of 2011. He'd come to believe, he said at the time, that the 1.7 million members of the nation's second-largest credit union deserved to know if their organization was financially sound. So CQ posted its number 2 CAMEL rating on its website. Attempts to reach Blaine, who was out of town the week of February 25th, for further comment were not successful. Next up, Corn Savior. Seeds developed by Syngenta and RTP are resistant to rootworms. By Lauren K. Onisores. In the quiet of a cornfield, a life-or-death battle is raging. Each cornstalk swaying in the breeze is being attacked by pests that can result in the loss of billions of dollars worth of grain. But farmers have allies and scientists who are developing corn seeds that are genetically engineered with traits that fend off such assaults. A particular enemy of corn are rootworms that have become known as the billion-dollar pests for the damage they do. Dirk Benson, head of corn trait projects at Syngenta, estimates losses of as much as $5 billion a year due to invasions by rootworms, which attack at ground level before flying insects even have their shot at the stalks. It's a moth larva that feeds on the roots of plants, explains Nathan Fields, director of biotechnology for the St. Louis-based Corn Growers Association. And its appetite is incredible, resulting in significant root loss that not only stunts the corn stalk's growth, decreasing yields, but also destabilizes the corn. We shook a plant and it just fell down, recalls Hope Hart, a team leader and scientist at Syngenta. A light breeze can do the same thing, but the stalk with 5307, it just stayed there. 5307, to which Hart refers, is a recently approved Syngenta seed technology that's now called AgriSure Duracade. It gained approval after more than a decade of research and joins three other genetically modified traits that resist rootworm attacks. AgriSure Duracade is the second for Syngenta, and it was created in Research Triangle Park from bacteria research spearheaded by people like Hart. Bacterial infections are common in plants. Infections such as crown gall, the bulge that's sometimes seen on oak trees. We thought, you can take out the disease-causing DNA from bacteria and put in something valuable, says Hart. The focus was on BT bacteria, already used by organic farmers, and something everyone is exposed to, though they may not know it. It's everywhere, Hart says. If you ever got any dirt on you, you've been exposed. Bacillus thuringiensis, BT, creates proteins that are natural insecticides. The proteins are specific for certain insects that have receptors or triggers for the proteins. They have a specific mechanism of action, she says. If it's not activated, they're a big blob of insoluble protein. Syngenta engineered the protein to react to one specific target, the gut of a rootworm. The rootworm activates it, and the protein binds to the gut and pokes holes, killing the insect, she explains. The discovery led to Syngenta's first anti-rootworm trait, AgriSure, which was approved in 2006. Hart's team then decided to see what else the platform could do. We asked, can we broaden its spectrum, she says. I was swapping bits of protein with other proteins targeted for other pests. And something unexpected happened. It didn't work at all, she laughs. Like most things in science, it wasn't a eureka moment. That's not what I expected moment. What did happen, however, was a new protection against rootworm. The newly engineered protein was activated by a different receptor, leading to the just-approved AgriSure Duracade trait. But why two traits? If you're just using a single mode of action, Mother Nature has a tendency to find a way around that, explains Fields. To be able to put two modes of action out there at the same time greatly increases the durability of each one. Syngenta packages both traits along with other pest control variants and expects the first corn seed utilizing the new technology to reach farmers in 2014. It's big business for the Swiss biotech company, says Syngenta spokesman Stephen Goldsmith. In the United States, there are about 300,000 corn growers, overseeing more than 96 million acres of corn, says Fields. But AgriSure Duracade doesn't mean that Syngenta and companies like it are ceasing their research. Rootworm products have worked, pointed out Fields. But, as he says repeatedly, Mother Nature has a way of counteracting science, meaning biotechs have to keep innovating counterattacks. And now in a complimentary article to what was just read, approvals, but still a long way to go. This article is also by Lauren K. Onisors. Syngenta's new rootworm slaying corn seed has now achieved approvals from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. But that doesn't mean its development is complete. Mylord Araba, product lead for Syngenta, has been overseeing the pre-commercial development of AgriSure Duracade, and he has a lot of work to do to take the new seed to farmers. I link the development and commercialization, he explains. He's been working on the pre-commercialization stage for 3 years, and it's just step 5 out of 7. Granted, regulatory compliance was a huge hurdle, but that readies it for market in only the United States. By the time the seed is ready to be shipped to farmers in 2014, he's aiming to meet requirements for key international markets. The trait at the core of the science is going to come into two different corn seed products, one with 5 traits, another with 6. Both seeds have traits to protect against above and below ground pests. Specifically, the seeds will have defenses against rootworm and the likes of corn borers, corn earworms, and cutworms. While the traits are developed in Research Triangle Park, Manufacturing requires a lot of farmland, so farmers in the Midwest are contracted to breed new seeds from Syngenta technology on thousands of acres. The growers produce the seed, and that's what Syngenta sells to farmers, Iravas explains, and that takes time. Those farmers will grow the corn this summer so they can harvest in the fall, in time for seed to be shipped to farmers by a spring 2014 target date. While that's going on, Araba and team will be working on regulatory compliance for international markets. The main targets are Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Mexico, and Canada. Araba expects to have import approval by the time the seed is ready to sell. The entire process to bring a trait from research to commercialization typically takes about 10 years and costs about $100 million. It has been compared to the approval process for human drugs. It's not as though R&D labs can crank these out at a fast rate, explains Nathan Fields, director of biotechnology for the National Corn Growers Association. There's a lot that goes into it. And that's why only three companies have approved traits to deal with rootworm: Monsanto, Dow, and Syngenta. And because the products are genetically modified, the safety requirements are extensive, says Hope Hart, a Syngenta developing scientist and product safety team leader. A total of 80 safety studies were performed to ensure that the proteins hit the correct target, and only that target, the rootworm. And those studies added to the overall development time frame and project cost. Our crops are safe to eat and safe for the environment, she says. Syngenta reported global sales of corn and soybean seeds last year of $1.836 billion, which was up 25% over 2011. The company expects the new trait to play a big role in future growth. Continuing on, Duke China campus hit with delay in launching. By Jason DeBruin from Durham. Duke University leaders characterize additional delays at its project in Kushan, China, as a positive, not a negative. At a recent meeting of the university's academic council, a powerful body at Duke that represents the faculty, Duke Provost Peter Lange announced another delay in construction at Duke Kushan University, the campus in China that will employ Duke professors and confer Duke degrees. It's at least the fifth delay, and as recently as August 2012, Duke expected to open DKU by this fall. That was pushed back to the beginnings of 2014 in January, then again to the fall of 2014 in February. In 2011, when delays and cost overruns first surfaced, members of the faculty raised pointed concerns. Academic Council Chairwoman Susan Lozier once described some of the feelings towards the initiative as though a rocket is being assembled before we know whether there is a rocket fuel available or rocket fuel affordable. Her statements were decidedly different in February when she said, "I guess I've already always expected some construction delay," but that she did not see a walk back in enthusiasm. Other members of the faculty did not publicly raise concerns with the delays or subsidies around or from the Duke campus in Durham this time around. In his remarks about construction delays, Lang also revised the subsidy that leadership expects Duke to contribute to the project. It now sits at $41 million over 8 years, as opposed to the previous estimate of $37 million for 7 years. Duke has also committed $8 million to fund the master plan, building design, and construction oversight. Construction delays came from Duke not settling for a second-rate facility, says Lang. He cited an example in which construction crews in Kushan installed ventilation ductwork below the ceilings when the plans called for them to be above the ceilings. Duke leadership decided to ask crews to redo the ductwork, leading to a delay. Duke stresses quality over time, Lang told the academic council. The difficulty isn't compounded when you are doing something 12,000 miles away, in a different language and a different culture. Later, at a meeting of university trustees, President Richard Broadhead called the delays a positive more than a negative, according to the Duke Chronicle, the independent student newspaper. The delays allow administrators to get the course offerings just right, Broadhead reasoned. Duke is still waiting for final approval from the Chinese Ministry of Education to offer academic courses. Duke already has preliminary approval and intends to submit its application for final approval of Duke Kushan University in April. However, the approval process could take months. And now from the real estate section of Amanda Jones Hoyle. Foreclosures are abating across the market. Foreclosure rates on home mortgage loans in the Triangle are falling, but the number of homeowners turning to short sale opportunities could be masking lingering distress in parts of the region's housing market. An estimated 19% of all home sales in the Raleigh-Cary metro area in 2012 were classified as non-foreclosure short sales, meaning that the sale price was below the estimated amount of all outstanding loans for a given property. The number of homes sold as short sales was up by 33% over the year prior, according to RealtyTrack, a housing industry research firm. In the Durham-Chapel Hill area metro area, 13% of all home sales were short sales, an increase of 64% from the year prior, RealtyTrack reports. Short sales are on the rise as a better alternative to foreclosure in many areas. Good news for buyers and investors in markets where short sales are closing more quickly at solid discounts, says Darren Bloomquist, vice president of RealtyTrack. On average, short sale transactions in the Raleigh-Cary area brought prices below the mortgage value in 2012, as compared to a foreclosed home sale that sold for $74,641 below a home's value. For the Durham area, short sales were $44,703 below value on average, while foreclosure sales were $53,576 below value, according to RealtyTrack. This week's technology column by Lauren K. Onisorge explores big data to rule in health sector, the conference said. Big data will be part of the future of healthcare. It's a point echoed by leaders at the CED Life Science Conference, held at the Raleigh Convention Center on February 27th and 28th. Ask WellPoint Incorporated Chief Medical Officer Dr. Samuel Nussbaum, who says big data can go a long way towards improving both cost and outcomes. If you're getting treated, flip a coin, he says, that is the likelihood that the care will be scientifically based. His main point? Focus on effective treatments and science and stop investing in things that aren't working. Collaborate and communicate. But it isn't so easy. Think about how many academic articles are published each year. How can all that information be integrated with something that can impact treatment? Artificial intelligence, Nussbaum says, referring to WellPoint's recent collaboration with the Watson system from IBM. We are at the earliest phases of this, he said. Big data will change healthcare, says Nussbaum. This week's Spotlight on Law features an article from Don Seifert. Mr. Seifert is an associate editor with the MHT Boston Business Journal, a sister publication. Have you filed your patent application? Change is coming. The America Invents Act, signed into law by President Barack Obama in 2011, takes full effect on March 16th. It's an overhaul that has been anticipated for years by both the technology and biotech industries, aligning the U.S. system of granting patents to better match that of the rest of the world. The biggest change will be going from a first-to-invent standard to a first-inventor-to-file system. But the new rules also institute several procedural changes, such as creating a simple and relatively inexpensive way to challenge the validity of patents for a 9-month period after they are granted. While the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office only has compiled data on patent application through December, patent lawyers say they expect the crunch will come late next week to take advantage of rules which they say are favorable to patent holders. Jason Mirabito, founding partner and co-chair of the intellectual property practice at Mintz, Levin, Cohen, Ferris, Glusky, and Popeo in Boston, says that based on the number of seminars law firms have dedicated to the topic in recent weeks, he expects a lot of last-minute filings. I think there's going to be a surge, he said. Last time we saw a spike, like the one expected next week, was in 1995, he said, the date of the last major overhaul when the life of a patent changed from 17 years from the date of issuance to 20 years from the date of filing. Mirabito said the new rules simplify the process of deciding who gets a patent by ensuring that the first person or business which files for a patent can also prove it legitimately invented the product described would get it. But it also posits a post-grant review process which enables anyone to challenge a patent much more cheaply than that the current methods, which include an arcane process known as inter partes examination or filing a civil lawsuit. That, says Mirabito, will be a decided difference a couple of years down the road when patents are granted for applications filed on March 16th or later, subject to the post-grant review. Others granted around the same time, but which were filed just a day earlier, will be immune to such challenges, he says. Another rule change involves transitional applications, those filed with the intent of clarifying the patent in subsequent filings. Boston attorney Tom Engelliner says the new rules clearly state that follow-up filings to a provisional application must be completed within a year and cannot contain any claims that weren't in the original filing. This week's Washington Watch by Kent Hoover. Mr. Hoover is the chief of Triangle Business Journal's Washington Bureau. Up to 1.6 million new jobs could be created over the next 10 years by granting visas to foreigners who start businesses in the U.S., according to the Kauffman Foundation, a Kansas City organization that studies and promotes entrepreneurship. The recently introduced Startup Act 3.0 includes a provision that would grant startup visas to 75,000 foreigners who already are in the U.S. on H-1B visas or F-1 student visas and start businesses here. If these individuals hire at least 2 full-time employees, family members don't count, and invest or raise at least $100,000 for their business in the first year, their visas would be extended for 3 years. After 3 years, if these entrepreneurs have hired, on average, 1 additional employee per year, they may apply for a green card, giving them permanent resident status in the U.S. Kauffman researchers used the U.S. Census Bureau's business dynamic statistics, which track job creation and destruction, and business openings and closings, to estimate how many jobs would be created by the Startup Visa program. It estimates that 37,108 businesses started by the first round of Startup Visa recipients would still be operating in 4 years. Over 10 years, the program would create between 500,000 and 1.6 million jobs. Also on this article is the Keystone Pipeline. The Obama administration inched closer to approving the Keystone XL pipeline when the State Department issued a draft environmental impact statement that concluded the project would have little impact on climate change. The document doesn't make any recommendations on whether the pipeline should be approved. The department is waiting for public comment. But supporters of the pipeline liked what they read, and opponents were disappointed. Business groups that favor the project see the report as a good sign that President Barack Obama will grant a permit for the pipeline. The project would bring crude oil from Canada's tar sands to Gulf Coast refineries. No matter how many times the pipeline is reviewed, the result is the same. No significant environmental impact, says Marty Durbin, Executive Vice President of the American Petroleum Institute. Others disagree. Mining the tar sands would be a disaster for our climate, says Danielle Deutrich, Canada Project Director for the Natural Resources Defense Council. And the FDIC reported that net income at the banks and savings institution and insurers rose to $34.7 billion in the fourth quarter of 2012, a 37% increase over profits during the same quarter a year earlier. For 2012 as a whole, bank earnings topped $141 billion, second only to 2006's $145 billion. Overall lending increased by $118.2 billion in the fourth quarter, while industrial lending was up by $53.4 billion. And now a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activity. By Todd Cohen. This article is entitled, Raleigh Nonprofit has raised $870 million given $41 million since 2005. While keeping a low profile, the Raleigh affiliate of the Alpharetta, Georgia-based National Christian Foundation has grown rapidly since it began operating in January 2005. The affiliate has received more than $870 million in contributions of cash, stock, and other assets, including $34.9 million in 2012. It has also facilitated grants totaling nearly $41.1 million, including more than 2,600 grants totaling nearly $10.5 million in 2012. A community foundation that works with individuals and groups to create and manage charitable funds that support a broad range of causes, the Raleigh office has one of the smallest staffs among the 28 affiliates of the National Foundation, with only two people working full-time and one working part-time. Yet, it is the sixth largest affiliate based on total cash and assets under management, says Alana Linden, its president. And it plans this year to add at least two staff members, she says. Most donors to the affiliate are mid to high net worth individuals who are typically business owners, entrepreneurs, and investment or financial professionals. People with a situation where they are not just dealing with a cash salary, Linden says. They own things, businesses, investments. The biggest group of its donors are referred by the five members of its board, which is chaired by Cliff Benson III, president of the Palin Foundation, or by its existing donors, and the second biggest group are referred by nearly 40 professional advisors, accountants, and lawyers who work with the foundation. Funds through referrals from advisors total roughly $10 million, or 45% of the affiliate's current cash balance. Like a typical community foundation, Linden says, the affiliate provides back-office support for donors, handling regulatory compliance for their funds, issuing receipts and quarterly statements to donors, and, through a password-protected website, provides a dashboard that includes information about their contributions and grants. The local office, supported by a team of attorneys and other professionals who are among the 100 employees working in the Georgia office, also provides advice and technical assistance on how to handle issues such as charitable giving, management of assets, and the sale of non-cash gifts, such as real estate, businesses, or restricted securities. Unlike many community foundations, however, the affiliate typically works with donors who give away a big share of their funds each year rather than letting them accumulate value, Linden says. We're not focused on being a foundation that money sits in, she says. We actually want it to get out into the community. The affiliate, which has the mission of enabling Christians to give wisely, supports churches and their outreach ministries, as well as a broad range of causes such as human services, education, poverty, international issues, the environment, and emergency relief. To understand what somebody really cares about, look at their checkbook to see what they're spending money on, Linden says. If people want to develop a passion for a cause, they should just start by giving and see how that changes them. This week's guest column on the Viewpoint page is by Jen Kennerly, who is in the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association's Regulatory and Policy Analyst position, and Betsy McCorkle is Director of Government Affairs. This is a document summarizing the report's findings, and it's available on the organization's website. This article is entitled Clean Energy, Clear Benefits. In his inaugural address, Governor Pat McCrory laid out a vision for a state government that encourages entrepreneurship and promotes an environment that encourages growth. Since 2007, state policies encouraging the growth of our clean energy industry have helped to do just that. Meanwhile, electricity customers have more energy choices and savings are on their electric bills. To gain an independent, objective, and full-spectrum view of the total impact of these clean energy projects, the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association asked the researchers at RTI International and La Capra Associates to help us understand the economic impact of these projects, as well as their cost to North Carolina electricity customers. In their report, the researchers found the policies most responsible for driving clean energy development with the state's Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency Portfolio Standard, an investment tax credit, and the Utility Savings Initiative, a program that encourages energy savings in state buildings. The researchers found these policies were responsible for these impacts since 2007. 1. $1.4 billion in direct investment in clean energy projects statewide and nearly $500 million in 2012 alone. 2. $1.7 billion in total gross state product. 3. 21,162 job years. A job year equals one person working full-time for 1 year since 2007, a period in which North Carolina lost 100,000 jobs. 4. For each $1 spent on the renewable energy tax credit, clean energy development returned $1.87 through state and local tax receipts. This is money that can be spent on core government functions such as education, transportation, and public safety. 5. Clean energy investment exceeded $100 million in each of Davidson, Person, and Robeson counties, while investment ranged from $25 million to $100 million in each of Beaufort, Cabarrus, Catawba, Cleveland, Duplin, Mecklenburg, and Wake counties. As McCrory and the General Assembly consider an energy strategy for our state, this study should encourage them to applaud the success of the clean energy industry and maintain the policies that are enabling more market competition and choice for consumers. This week's guest opinion on the Viewpoint page is by Mr. Kevin Ring. Mr. Ring is the Director of Community Growth for the Institute of Work Comp Professionals, which trains insurance agents to help employers reduce workers' compensation expenses. This article is entitled "The Changing Definition of Today's Older Workers." The workforce is getting older. People are retiring later in life than ever before. This trend has been a major concern for those in the health and safety field because the common knowledge has been that older workers are more prone to suffer very expensive injuries. However, new research from the National Council on Compensation Insurance, NCCI, has cast doubt on this very conventional wisdom, or at the very least, potentially changed the definition of older workers. NCCI studied different age groups and the rate at which they get injured. They found younger workers, under 35, had substantially more cuts on their fingers, and older workers, over 35, suffer more cases of carpal tunnel and more cervical injuries, although the numbers are startlingly similar. So that quiets the argument about the aging workforce causing more injuries, but what about the cost? The research shows that there is a substantial cost difference between younger and older workers, but the split isn't necessarily where you might expect. Workers between the ages of 20 and 24 create much lower costs and fewer days out, but once workers reach 35, the cost of their injuries are very similar to older workers. What does this all mean? To start with, it now largely defines an older worker as someone who grew up listening to disco instead of Elvis. This means that someone over 35, not just someone belonging to the traditional over 65 group, is now being classified as an older worker. It should also prompt businesses to strongly focus on the things that can reduce injury costs for everyone. Injury prevention for employees should begin before they even become employees during the hiring process. Start with a written functional description for the position that is open. Once that is complete, it is critical that the candidate you select be given a conditional offer of employment. This document is a bona fide job offer with the caveat that you can withdraw the offer if they are physically or mentally unable to do the job with reasonable accommodation. Once this is complete, have the candidate go to the doctor and complete a post-offer pre-placement medical questionnaire. Having this completed allows a physician to ask questions relevant to the job and to let the employer know whether or not the candidate is fit for the job. If they are, it's time to get started. If not, you'll have to find another suitable candidate. Once an employee is on the job, it is critical that they are always mindful of how they are doing their job. Far more injuries are caused by unsafe acts by employees than any unsafe conditions in their workplace. Employees that feel rushed are more likely to set safety aside in the name of meeting a deadline, and those decisions result in accidents that could have been prevented. When you take all these steps and have a workforce that is fit for work and doing their job safely, then the focus turns to what happens when an accident does happen and an employee is injured. Employees must know before they get hurt who they should talk to when they suffer an injury. Immediate injury reporting is a key to keeping injury costs as low as possible. Studies have shown that the cost of an injury go up when there is a delay in reporting. Once the injury is reported, getting the proper treatment is key. Your business should have a relationship with an occupational medical provider in your area. You can find board-certified occupational doctors on the web at acoem.org. Even if there isn't an occupational medicine specialist in your town, you can develop a relationship with a physician and send your injured employees to that doctor. The goal of having a relationship with a work comp specialist medical provider is to ensure that the doctor knows your business and the physical demands that your employees are under. When a doctor knows that you will accept an employee back to work on transitional duty, they are far more likely to send them back to work rather than send them home to sit on the couch. When an employee is at work, they are less likely to hire an attorney and more likely to work hard to get back to their full duty position. This process not only gets employees back to work more quickly, it also reduces the amount of money that the insurance company spends on your employee injuries, reducing your experience mod and therefore your workers' compensation insurance cost. The workforce is getting older, and we need to be mindful of accommodations that older workers may need today that they didn't need before. However, this new research from NCCI should sharpen employers' focus on what can drive down injury rates and costs, like hiring the right people, training them to do their job safely, and when accidents do happen, make sure they are reported immediately and treated by a skilled physician who will send them back to work rather than home. Burrage Music is closing after 60 years in Raleigh. After nearly 60 years in business, Burrage Music Company in Raleigh is closing. Co-owner Dee Dee Neville, who is the daughter of Burrage Music founder Willard Burrage and her husband David Neville, have decided to retire, and they expect to close the store on Green Road by the end of April. We did try to find a buyer for the business, she says, but nobody wanted all this sheet music. Besides sheet music, the store offers instrument rentals and repairs. Burrage Music opened in 1956 after Willard and Lucy Burrage purchased the former Gupton Music Store that was in downtown Raleigh. They moved the store to its current location at 4900 Green Road in 1974, and the Nevilles purchased the company after Burrage died in 1988. Dee Dee and David Neville, who are now 67 and 66 years old, she says, are ready to retire. It's time to prop our feet up and take a couple of trips, she says. Yikes! Snakes! Snakes! And more snakes! That's a promise from the folks at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, the state's most visited tourist site in 2012, by the way, about their upcoming Reptile and Amphibian Day, March 16th. On that day, the main museum and the new Nature Research Center will be transformed into a herpetological paradise. Biz looked that up for you. Herpetology is a branch of zoology concerned with the study of amphibians and reptiles. The free exhibit, which will run from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., will offer up-close and personal encounters with boas, python, pit vipers, rattlesnakes, and other eeky creatures, as well as more pedestrian animals like frogs, toads, salamanders, turtles, and lizards. Also look for more than 50 interactive exhibits and other activities. And if you're in the mood to eat some python, check this out. Bull City Burger and Brewery in Durham has declared March to be Exotic Meat Month. Think of different meat every week, ranging from ostrich to beaver to python to alligator. Since some of the meats are pretty hard to get, there may be as few as 12 servings available. The idea isn't just to eat the meat, but also to learn about other cultures and the foods that are consumed. The 100-year-old home at 101 South Bloodworth Street in downtown Raleigh has been renamed Claremont House for the Raleigh Company that will be occupying its rooms. Dana Huggins, owner of the Claremont Communications, a public relations and marketing firm, is moving her business from the Longview Center building on South Person Street. Through an LLC, Huggins paid $384,000 for the nearly 3,000-square-foot building in mid-February. It looks like the Triangle Business Journal is going to lower the old handicap. The Tee It Forward initiative has hit Cary's Prestonwood Country Club. What is Tee It Forward, you ask? It's a joint initiative with the United States Golf Association. The PGA of America has created a program to further promote the game of golf by allowing players to tee off from tee boxes best suited to their average driving distance. That's driving, as in driving a golf ball. At Prestonwood, the implementation of this program provides 15 additional playing options for members and guests. Further, new silver tees have been added, creating an opportunity to play from a more manageable yardage. Gone are the days when the red tees were referred to as the ladies' tees, or the green tees as the senior tees, says Prestonwood's Director of Golf Operations, Larry Connor. All of Prestonwood's tees are officially rated for both men and women, and we encourage our members to play the set of tees from which they find the game most enjoyable. It may look like a light bulb, but it's actually a cow, a cash cow. That's the hope, at least behind Cree's Tuesday announcement of a $10 LED light bulb. Mike Watson, Vice President of Corporate Marketing at the North Carolina State Spinoff, says that in addition to the 200 people, Cree Incorporated has already hired locally to assemble the bulbs, there's potential for even more jobs. We're hoping to need more bodies in Durham, for sure, but really what we're looking for is to drive adoption of the Cree LED light bulb, he says. Watson adds that due to the low price point, consumers finally have a reason to adopt the more energy-efficient technology. Speaking of energy, North Carolina cracks the top 10 list in adding clean energy jobs. North Carolina was among the top 10 states in the production of clean energy jobs in 2012, according to the Washington-based group Environmental Entrepreneurs, E2. Announced 2012 projects in clean energy and clean transportation are poised to create 110,000 jobs across the country, the group says, and it plans to release a detailed state-by-state jobs creation report later in the week. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. I'm Al Reynolds, and we hope you've enjoyed our broadcast, and I'm reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time. Thank you.